I'm Patrick Campbell, Senior Editor of Practical Cardiology, and for this special edition National Wear Red Day episode of Practical Cardiology, you'll get to check out an interview I had with Dr. Jennifer Majersik, Professor of Neurology at the University of Utah and Associate Editor of the journal Stroke, a journal of the American Heart Association. Our conversation is centered around a special Heart Month edition of Stroke, focusing on disparities in treatment and outcomes among women who experience a stroke. With this in mind, the editorial team from Stroke highlights 9 different studies in this month's edition, illuminating different disparities in care, outcomes, and authorship of studies based on gender. Additionally, Dr. Majersik also reflects on her personal experiences as a female neurologist and how the hurdles she faced are different from those faced by early career clinicians today. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Dr. Majersik. All right, well, welcome to all our listeners. Today I am here with Dr. Majersik. Dr. Majersik, would you mind just giving our guests a brief background on your expertise and your role, and then we can sort of dive into our discussion?
Sure, it's nice to be with you today. So I'm a professor of neurology at the University of Utah, and clinically I see stroke patients on the inpatient side and the outpatient side. And administratively, I direct the stroke center here. And then I also run a clinical stroke trials network that's in our region of multiple states. And I think one of the reasons I'm talking to you today is that I'm an associate editor for the journal Stroke, which has had a special issue out for women and women's issues related to stroke.
Thank you for that. And yes, that is a bit of the reason for our discussion today. The February Stroke Journal's special edition issue features 9 different studies highlighting disparities, sort of gender disparities in stroke and sort of outcomes, underrepresentation. And now, but based on our discussion, it seems that we've made some pretty good progress in terms of getting more women involved in these trials from what you and I discussed earlier. What's it like for you as a neurologist trying to ensure that the proper amount of women are included in these trials and that there's also proper amount of representation in terms of authorship among women when we conduct these sort of trials?
Right. So when I'm enrolling in trials, from the beginning, we try to create a plan across our center and the other centers that we work with to make sure that we've thought of barriers that could be unique to women or to men, you know, either one. And so that we are trying to approach both genders with the intent to enroll, so that we get a good representation of each of them. And one of the things that was brought out in one of the papers in this issue is that sometimes trials, for example, will limit enrollment to an upper age cutoff of, say, 80. And the reason they might do that is it's good intentions. They want people who are more likely to survive a long time, which, you know, as you hit 80, your chances go down. But that unintentionally reduces the likelihood of women being in the trials because women have stroke at higher ages than men. So it's not typically that a study will say we don't want women in the trial, but they might create barriers that are unintentional, such as that. So I guess that's the starting point, is just to look at the enrollment criteria and see, are there things within those criteria that are going to reduce the inclusion of women?
And now let me ask you, as someone who's been practicing and involved in clinical trials, have you seen an increase in sort of the number of female colleagues you see joining you as part of the authorship of these trials, or is this something that has remained stagnant? Because I know it's been a talking point for research in the past.
Yeah, so a completely different issue is who's conducting the trials, right? I think anecdotally, I've seen a growth of women be interested in research. But there are barriers that, you know, as you know, the pandemic has even worsened because women do often bear the majority of child caring. And so sometimes that can keep them from attending meetings. I have a mentee who I won't name to, you know, call her out, but she was telling me that having to attend in-person meetings was a problem for her because of trying to be with her kids for various sporting events and other things. And it was something that she just felt conflicted about because she wanted to be in two places at once. So that doesn't necessarily mean that men don't face those same pressures. So I don't want to say that men don't attend to their children, because of course many of them, and most of them do. But I do think that there are those differences in how we parent has caused some trouble. On the other hand, I've seen a real attempt in our community of neurology to include women at higher numbers, to look for their ones who are doing excellent work and placing them on steering committees and asking to make sure that we have representation on the trial committees and planning committees, et cetera. So I don't have exact data for women authorship within our journal, within Stroke, but it's certainly something that we've paid a lot of attention to in terms of trial planning, that kind of thing. I can say this though, when the Stroke Trial Network started up that I'm part of, StrokeNet, I was one of only three female PIs, principal investigators out of 25, and the other two were co-PIs. I was the only one who was the solo PI. And now, 7 years later, that's changed. There's more women now than there were then.
Wow, that's fantastic to hear. Now, one of the other main things that jumps out at me when I was reading the AHA press release about this special edition journal was there was a study that sort of highlighted advances that we've seen in stroke, in particular treatment. And while we've seen we had larger disparities in the past and we've seen them sort of equal out a bit, we've seen outcomes improve for women. Why do you think that we still are seeing some worse outcomes in women than men in terms of, say, 5-year survival after stroke? Obviously, you mentioned earlier, women typically suffer strokes at older ages, which could impact this. Do you think that it could still have anything to do with, say, implicit bias or anything like that in sort of the day-to-day clinical setting?
I mean, these are the questions that we all have, right? So that the press release you're talking about, said that women are more likely to have a second stroke, they're more likely to die after their stroke, more likely to have cardiovascular complications after their stroke than men, and all that was pretty concerning. But then the researchers did find that a lot of that was mediated by age, meaning that because the women were older when they had their strokes, older people are more likely to die, regardless if they're men or women. And so, but when you have more women in that category, it makes it harder. And I think too, women are more likely to be widowed. They don't have the social support that a man does when their spouse if your spouse is still surviving, then you have more support from that spouse, whether it's a man or a woman. But women are more likely to be widowed at those older ages because of men's early mortality or earlier mortality. So I think there's a lot of different issues. One thing is that women do tend to go to the doctor more, so they are a little bit better at seeking care. But a lot of times their symptoms that they have are not as traditional. So sometimes they may be overlooked. That's another thing that we've talked about for a long time. It's clearly a really complicated issue. And one thing that I'm pleased with is that throughout my career, I've seen more and more data coming out to try to unravel these kinds of things. So even that paper you're just talking about, we didn't have that data before. So I feel like we're getting closer to the answers over time.
Now, let me ask you, have you seen, and you mentioned the StrokeNet network that you are a part of, have you seen institutions put forth initiatives to sort of get young career physicians, young women physicians more involved in clinical trials or more involved in ongoing projects that they might have going on?
Definitely. There's a lot of mentoring options for women these days that were not there in the past. I only know of organizations that I'm a part of, but I do know that what's called the AAMC, the American Academy of Medical Colleges, Medical Centers. Sorry, I probably just butchered that, what it stands for, but that the AAMC has women-specific mentoring programs, whether you're a researcher or a clinician, but if you're in leadership, basically. The American Academy of Neurology has programs that are targeting young women to try to improve their leadership skills and to help them to lean into the role, as was famously said by Sheryl Sandberg. And so those professional development groups really have taken it upon themselves to say, hey, we have equal number of women coming in at the assistant professor level or coming into medical school, but we don't have equal number of women in leadership positions. So what's happening? What's within that gap? What's contained in that gap? And how can we make that better? So it's been kind of delightful actually to be a part of it, both on the receiving end where I have been mentored, and now I get to give back and mentor others as well, and show them that it's possible. to have a career in research and in leadership and still and to be a woman, basically.
Now, in that mentor role, obviously the hurdles that are facing women neurologists, cardiologists, women in medicine have been sort of similar as time goes on, but they've also been very different. Obviously, 2020 taught us that not every year is ever the same, and sometimes they can be very, very different. What kind of hurdles do you see young women doctors having to overcome now that may be a little bit different than the ones that you had, that you were facing when you were first beginning your practice?
I mean, one nice thing, this is actually an anti-hurdle, I guess, but there are more women in leadership. So you can look up and say, hi, I could be like her. You know, I could do that. I'm not the first one to think about this as a possibility. Yeah, I think that's really helpful. It's helpful to see people who look like you or might have a similar path as you. So I do really appreciate being able to visualize something that you might want and that helps you achieve it. I know that, you know, this is a two-gendered question, right? So there's men and women. And I do think the men of our society as a whole have taken on more of those home caring things that they didn't used to do. That said, there's a ton of pressures on parents right now. One of my mentees is a man, and he had a child during this last year, or his wife did, and they couldn't put him in daycare because of the pandemic, and he's trying to write grants. And so lots and lots of pressures on families as a whole. But whether it's the men not stepping up to the plate or the women owning the plate too much, I don't know. But there is a predominance of the women taking on those additional childcare duties and home duties in general. So I try to tell my mentees that they get to create a life how they want. And I always say to them, you want your partner to be as good as he can be. So help him to do that too. So in other words, let him change the diapers. Let him take the kids to the parent-teacher conference or the soccer game. And it's okay. You don't have to do every single one of those jobs yourself. But it seems like women have to be, I don't know, like find the internal permission to allow that to happen sometimes. That's a lot on parenting. It might be beyond the scope of this interview, my parenting philosophy.
I think you make a great point. For a while in society, we have depended on women, especially women physicians, to basically be superheroes. And I think that it's something that obviously you might have to address a little bit or tweak a little bit to create a level playing field for everybody.
Well, and I remember, I'll quote my dad, unbeknownst to my father, but when I was making my kindergartner make his own lunch because my husband was out of town, I had to get to work. I said to my dad, I'm probably the worst mother in the world. I'm the only one who makes her kid, you know, his kid, her kindergartner make lunch for himself. And he just said, Jenny, don't ever apologize for teaching your children life skills. Your child can make his own lunch, as you know, presuming he's doing it safely. And that's okay. And so it's like letting go of some of that guilt. And I think for me, that was a really important thing. And I continue to feel that way today. It's okay for my children are much older, but they can make dinner and I don't have to do all of it myself. And it gives me time to professionally grow as well.
All right. And now speaking from a professional and personal side, let me ask you, Go Red for Women and sort of Wear Red Day is initiatives by the AHA, great initiatives. But it seems a lot of times when the AHA does these things, they're geared a little bit more toward public awareness, sort of promoting fundraising campaigns and bringing awareness from the public to these issues. What does it mean for you as a clinician when there's a day that's particularly for raising awareness about cardiovascular health in women? Or in this particular case, the AHA has chosen to highlight stroke for their February issue. So what's it mean for you when these days occur? And is it really as important as some of these organizations might want it to be?
That's a great question. I mean, sometimes you can have fatigue on all these days, right? You have a one color ribbon for one disease, another color ribbon for another disease. But the truth is that cardiovascular disease is the number one killer of women. And if you ask women out there, they almost will never tell you that. They'll say almost uniformly it's breast cancer. And I'm not to diminish the importance of breast cancer, which is, you know, a deadly, heartbreaking disease. But women are far more likely to die of cardiovascular disease, either stroke or heart attack. So I do view it as a chance to talk about that and to make sure my patients know it, but also our doctors, right? So if we just think that heart disease hits men in their 50s, right, which was sort of the old school thought, then you miss an opportunity to care for your patients in a more appropriate manner to really identify all of their risks. And I have mixed feelings about the cute red dress symbol that the Go Red uses. I remember the first time I had to speak at a Go Red event, and they said I had to wear a red dress. And I thought, well, I don't have one of those. So, as an introvert, it's not my favorite color, but I do like it because it's readily recognizable and really focuses it on the issues of women that are unique in many ways to the issues of men. So, as a female researcher and a female clinician, you know, of course, my heart is with women, but there's no question. So I do like to support it. And I think it's helped a lot. It opens up conversation in a way that it might not if the AHA wasn't promoting that day.
Definitely. I think that I always like to ask the question because obviously AHA does a great job of promoting it and advertising it, but it does at its essence seem like a day to create public awareness. And so it's always a little bit interesting to talk to. It almost seems like it could be Christmas for some female cardiologists. And other times it seems like they see it as a day that's for the media and for public awareness. So it's interesting to hear your take on it. And now just lastly, before I let you go, when we look at stroke care in regards to women in particular, what are some of the next steps that need to be taken to ensure equity across the board?
Yeah, I think equity includes so many different things, right? It includes patient awareness. So do they even know that they're at risk for stroke? Do they know what steps to take to reduce that risk? And then it takes access. So you have to be able to access care. And our rural communities, our urban communities, they don't have as many stroke neurologists and cardiologists as we need. So, you know, working on that and being able for women to access that care is not requires more than geographic, right, proximity. You have to have a job and insurance in this country, which right now with the pandemic is a huge problem. And it's being shown again, it's hitting women much more than it's hitting men because they tend to work in the fields that are going under in the pandemic in the service industry. So there's a lot of public health issues surrounding those types of concerns. And then we need to know, are there things that are more effective for women than men or the reverse? Are there things that we prescribe routinely or surgeries that we do that maybe we shouldn't, that because they're better for one gender than the other? There's a simple example of carotid artery, which is a procedure to unblock the arteries in the neck, and they don't they're more effective in men than women. And so we were just discussing that last week in our journal club, and that wasn't something our trainees knew. So we have to always be, you know, at least sharing the data we already have and then getting more data on these things. So like the National Institutes of Health, NIH, a couple of years ago put in a policy saying we have to analyze our data by gender or by sex so that we know when we do a big trial, are there differential effects on men versus women? And because right now, a lot of those trials are not reported that way. And so you get the aggregate answer that it does or doesn't work, but you don't get to find out does it or does it not work to men and to women. And we really need to, we do have different biologies. And I think it's important to recognize that and to analyze your data based on that.
Yeah, definitely. I think that last part was a great example. You have to identify the problems before you can really address them. So, but that was about it on my questions. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. And thank you for your contributions to putting together such a great edition for Stroke Day. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It's lovely to talk to you. And happy Go Red Day.
Thank you again to Dr. Majersik for taking part in that interview. That's it from this episode of Practical Cardiology. For the latest in cardiovascular care, be sure to head to practicalcardiology.com. Thank you for listening.